Welcome to The Gathering Resources. The following audio is from our breakout session entitled Trust-Based Philanthropy, Giving More Effectively Through Humility and Transparency. The session is moderated by Fred Smith and features Chris and Terry Bledsoe, Nathan and Julie Alamon, and Philip Lee.
I wrote down a quote from Isaac Watts. It said, "Learning to trust is one of life's most difficult tasks." And so what we thought we'd do is have our panelists talk a little bit about how have they learned to trust, how have they avoided cynicism and disillusionment and mistrust, how have they, you know, what's been their progress in this. And so of these six things, and I'll just rehearse them for you, you know, talk to us a little bit about one of those things in your giving over time that you've either learned to do well, you stubbed your toe, or you had some hard lessons, or you finally gave up and said, nah, this doesn't work, I'm going to go back to the other way of doing it. So Nathan and Julie, talk to us. The six were giving multi-year unrestricted funding, letting the nonprofit decide what best to do with it, doing the homework, simplify and streamline paperwork, being transparent and responsive, soliciting and acting on feedback, offering support beyond the check. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, any one or two of those six that you'd like to.
Okay, is this working? Not yet. Can you hear me now? Okay, so I'm going to talk about soliciting feedback. This is something that I really care about in the aspect of the relationship with grantees. Just for some perspective, I am the only staff person at our family foundation, and so it can be done with not much, you know, as big staff. But basically, some things that I've asked, and we do have an application that hopefully is streamlined, but you could give me feedback on that. but we ask how their experience is, basically, and then try to incorporate it back into the changes we make. One question we ask on every application is, what can we do more of or less of to improve our partnership? And, you know, you could argue that they're not going to be, like, totally honest with me, but I actually have gotten some pretty good feedback. And it can range from, you know, this question is repetitive to... we need more time to fill this out. You know, can you give us a month instead of 3 weeks or whatever it may be? We recently, for example, asked for a 5-minute video in lieu of a application to try something different. And I got a lot of feedback on that, which I can share later. But that was important. You know, like if I had just changed that and not asked what their experience was, you know, I think they would have felt like maybe at my mercy of like we have to just adapt to whatever you want. But I got, you know, some really interesting thoughts, and I would say it was split. I'll just say that in their opinion. But and then we also, to get data for ourselves, started asking how many hours it was taking for everyone to fill out our application and report, which was pretty simple to add. And I was shocked at, you know, like what I thought it would take them. It was maybe like 2x, you know, what it was actually taking them. And that was also important because we started paying the grantees who didn't get a grant. Sorry, we started paying nonprofits who didn't get a grant $1,000 for their time, and that was based on calculating the number of hours. I think there was an article I read that had a recommendation around that. So, and then lastly, I'll just say, because we care about feedback, we also started asking a question about how the nonprofits are asking for feedback from their clients, and if they're incorporating, how they're incorporating basically the voices of those they're serving to inform the programs they make, because we believe that's important. So, you know, wanted that to reflect.
Thanks, Julie. I'll share something a little bit differently from my experience working at Bridgespan. Bridgespan is a nonprofit that supports other nonprofits in questions of strategy, also supports funders. And I'll speak a little bit about, number one, the push toward less restricted funding or unrestricted funding, which, if you talk to a nonprofit leader, is often their like most valuable funding, just totally the thing that lets them do their work. Bridgespan 10 years ago happened upon an idea called the nonprofit starvation cycle. You may have heard about it. It's where well-intentioned funders do project-based funding and put sort of caps on the allowable expenses put upon those projects. But it has the dynamic where when a nonprofit delivers on that work, you know, does the work they promised to do, it actually costs more to do it than they're getting paid. And so it hollows out the core of the organization. Sort of like the used carsman joke, which I'm going to try to get out. It's we lose money on every deal, but we make it up in volume. That's sort of like the... I knew that would be good with Fred. It's like his... right there. And so the result of that, recently Bridgespan did a study of many of the leading sort of largest co-funded nonprofits in the U.S. and found that the big players are all in significant financial distress. Deficits, inadequate reserves, and it's because of this hollowing out, and it has the results of really lessening their ability to deliver impact. And so it's those unrestricted dollars, the sort of the risk funding that lets these leaders put the resources to where they're most needed. That's they're really good at that, and so the trust to come behind them makes a big difference.
Tom Tierney was the founder of Bridgespan, and I met Tom years ago when he had just started and had maybe two staff. What is Bridgespan now?
It's like 300 or 400.
Three or 400.
Yeah.
And
great that you know my boss's boss's boss too. That's great.
Yeah.
That's good.
Trust me. And Tom wrote this great article for The Gathering once, and he said, oftentimes funders treat nonprofits like they're taking off and they're asking them to drive across the country, and they say, I'll give you your first gallon of gas. And you've got to find your next gallon of gas from another funder and your next gallon of gas from another one. And he said, how concentrated do you think somebody can be on their larger mission if all they're thinking about is that next gallon of gas? And there's a, you know, there's this phrase that a lot of nonprofit leaders use. They say, every morning I wake up and I have to feed the beast. And that's what a lot of their lives are like. Every morning I wake up and I have to feed the beast. So I love these quotes. I'm going to throw these out because I think it's true. This is Harold Macmillan. A man who trusts nobody is apt to be the kind of man that nobody trusts. So as we're talking about trust, it's a two-way street. It's, am I trustworthy? Not just do I trust the nonprofit, but can they trust me? So I'd like the Bledsoes to talk a little bit about their experience with trust and building trust and what that's been like.
Yeah, I'll start off and let Terry finish it up. But, you know, trust is one of those things that you can't just have right away. And so when we started reading about the trust-based philanthropy, it kind of aligned with how we do giving anyway. But there's ways to streamline even that. The multi-year giving is something that we do participate in. And, you know, for me, I think it's important to make the receiver understand what our time frame is, because you don't want to be on a 3-year plan and they think you're on a 5-year plan, okay? And we can revisit it, but there's no surprises. I don't like surprises, and they don't want surprises. And we've done it both ways. We've contributed to building campaigns, which I'm sure a lot of people have done, that are specifically driven to one thing, but also on the operational side. But in order to do that, in order to get the trust, it does require you to do the homework. And I'm a financial guy, and so a lot of what I do is more through questions I ask. And it's not a audit of their books or something like that. It's more a conversational type question and answer. And that's where I start getting the buildup of trust for what we do. And, you know, you can tell when something just doesn't smell right or when something is an opportunity that it could go way beyond what the receiver, you know, may be even thinking. So the trust is something that takes homework, and it does take time, and it does take questions, you know. There aren't questions that are off the table in my mind. If you're going to be funding an organization doing something that you love or have a passion about, I think it does require you to do the homework. And if you don't, that doesn't guarantee it's going to work out either. And so I'm going to let Terry talk a little bit about the support beyond the check, because I think that's an important part of what we do too.
Yeah. I just want to add one thing to that. Chris usually will walk alongside a lot of our bigger recipients. And one of the things that he challenges them to do when we do a multi-year gift is to use that as fuel to get more multi-year gifts. Because usually if someone is giving to you multi-year, you know, there's a good reason. You're a good candidate for that. And he's just been an incredible motivator to these founders. And we generally work with startups and entrepreneurs, but we have some big organizations too. But just to use that capital of the relationship, you know, that we're building. And I always think that that's amazing. I'm not financial at all. I'm marketing, so. So I always think, and I always see 3 years later or 5 years later, whatever our commitment is, how the Lord has used that relationship and that seed, and it usually multiplies, you know, way bigger than even what we, you know, what we seeded. But the thing that I'm going to share is on the offer support beyond the check. And so when we started this journey with our family foundation, we didn't know anything. In fact, the first time we came, I found the gathering. You remember this, friend?
I remember.
I Googled Kingdom Strategic Giving, because we knew how to give. We just didn't know at this level. So we kind of came up with our own plan. We just prayed and said, Lord, show us how to do this. And if we make a mess, forgive us, you know. And so we decided our head, our hands, and our heart. So the check's the easy part. But usually we will serve on a board, one or both of us. We'll try to use our capital, our relational capital, introduce them to people that we know, whether it's funders or maybe it's people that, you know, can further what they do. We try to do experiential capital. We'll take them to a prayer retreat or to a marriage retreat and let them see how other ministries or other nonprofits maybe that are a little further down the road are operating. The other thing Chris does is he tries to get every nonprofit to at least act like they're for-profit. And he will walk alongside them as a financial to do that. And they almost need to talk him out of that mentality, which they never do. They always go the other way. But the other thing we do is we try to serve. And we have them in our home. We'll walk with them. And we do a lot of work with Plywood, which is a social startup incubator in our city. And so it really is speaking to this distribution of power, because these are the powerless in our community. And we're now getting to know people that we would never get to know any other way. And they're the most amazing. God is using them to change our city, no matter what you hear on the news. And it's just so neat to be a part of that. But we have to learn who they are and hear from them. So our biggest prayer is just, Lord, you know, leave us at the door and let us get to know this person. So we'll have them over. We have them to our lake house. We make sure they can all have their retreats, because all of those expenses, retreats, board retreats, they take away from the work. So we try to make sure that they can always come to the lake house or whatever. So those are just a few things we do.
I think I'm right on this, but I think I was at home on a Sunday morning and you called me and said, we're trying to learn about giving. And I'm thinking, I should probably be at church.
I probably should have too.
That's right. But I faked it and I said, can I call you back after the services? And we had this great conversation. That was the beginning of this whole relationship. But there's another quote. It's anonymous. And it says that trust comes on foot and leaves on horseback. And I wonder, how long does it take for you all to have a sense of building trust?
That's a tough question, but I would say we have it, we kind of made our process reflect that answer, I think, in that we, all of our new grants are just 1 year, and it's sort of like a let's get to know each other kind of thing, and then after a year, we say, hey, you can apply up to 3 years, and we usually do that up to 3 years, or we usually do 3 years because they always ask for 3 years, so that's what I would say.
So,
about a year.
Yeah, so it does come on foot. I mean, it comes slowly. What about y'all? Or do you just trust immediately?
No. It's not immediate. Yeah. You know, there's not a set time. Sometimes it takes longer to understand what they're doing and wanting to do and how they operate. And sometimes you get a feel quick. So I can't say a time frame for us, Brad. It's every one of them is different.
Hmm. Chris will usually meet with them and suggest they read a book. And really, a lot of it, besides our prayer and just we feel, you know, if it aligns with what we feel like God has called us to contribute to building, if they don't get back, and he'll say, read this book and let me know what you think of it, and then I'd like to hear more about your initiative or your startup. And if they don't read the book or they don't ever come, you know, you would be surprised how many people will make an initial ask or whatever, or even be introduced to you and not take the next step. So Chris is, he's sort of a, you know, proof in the pudding guy, and so usually that's what he does. It's amazing, the ones that come back and read the book and have it underlined and call him at home and say, you know, I'm reading this book and I'm having trouble with this part, or, but that's kind of an informal way that, but a movie is great too. That's, of course, they may not like it.
It's another great quote. Trust everybody, but cut the cards. So Philip, what have you learned about trust?
You know, I think people often say that change happens at the speed of trust, and so even within our own foundations, I think, so I'll take this probably a little bit more macro. I think when people use trust and trust-based philanthropy, I think they always think about the grantee relationship with the funder. But I think it's actually a larger ecosystem, if you'll let me use that word. But it's also like the board's relationship with us as staff, our staff's relationship with one another or with peers out there. I think all of these different parts need to be in harmony or in synchronous for this really to work, right? And if you're a family foundation, it's like one generation with the next gen. Like, is there trust there? Do you have that kind of relationship that it can all play through in terms of the way that you do your work, right? And so I think if I take that and how we explore trust with our grantees, and similar to the Alemans, we do 1 year for everybody the first year, and then it's 3 years after that, if everything goes well. But what we try to do is there's this notion that after I trust you, I'll be vulnerable. So we've tried to flip that, and it's like we'll be vulnerable and show you our warts and where we've made our mistakes, and we actually have a whole blog series called Face Plants, which is my favorite word for it, stumbles, trips, and face plants, about the mistakes that we've made as a foundation, right, to say we're not perfect, we don't know everything, and if we can do that, that's our invitation to you to perhaps be more open and share more of what's going on with you as well. That you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to give us the dog and pony. We don't want that because we won't learn as much and you won't be as honest about what the challenges are, right? If we really want to be your partner, we want to be there for the good and the bad and the ugly, right? And so that's our point of entry into some of these conversations, is really to say, if we can show our warts, hopefully you'll show a bit more of who you are and what you're up to as well.
George MacDonald was a 19th century writer who was pretty important in C.S. Lewis's life. And he said, to be trusted is a better compliment than being loved. And I sometimes think about, I'm asking to trust them. Am I trustworthy? And do I live up to my own standards that I require of them? And do you ever have the sense that that you have a responsibility to be trusted just as much as you require trustworthiness from those? And how do you watch yourself to make sure that you're trustworthy? Because foundations can be fickle, they can be flighty, they can do whatever they want to, and nobody ever asks many questions. How do you hold yourself to being trusted? Nathan?
I think the main, just sitting next to Julie is like my main like accountability mechanism, where she's like, you emailed them and didn't get back to them for like a week. That was like an insult, you know? You got to like pick up your game, because sure, they'll be polite and, you know, pick up the pieces, but that is one thing that comes to mind, just being in accountability within ourselves, one another, because you're right, there's no, like accountability is sort of self-imposed. I think the second thing is maybe a measure of humility, that because we, the younger family gives away a fair amount of money relative to the size of staff, our this sort of capacity for like checking up and like a sort of a full court press with grantees is pretty limited. And so it's a humility to realize they're doing their work and the center of their work is probably their beneficiaries or the change they want in the world. The center of their work isn't us. We're actually much less important. And so how can we just like audit the things we're doing that might are unintentionally conveying we think we're important or are the center of the story when we're not really? Anything you'd add?
I think sometimes I just get questions that reveal maybe a lack of, or like how I'm not being as transparent, which I think is related to trust. Like, I mean, recently an organization asked, what are your goals as a foundation and how are we helping you meet those goals? Which I thought was a really good question. And it like took a lot of thought. And, I mean, like, we have our goals on our website, and I'm like, well, they're there, you know, but like, are they looking at them? And I think that was an opportunity. It's just an opportunity, I think, at every point to be honest. And there are a lot of things on my wish list that I wish I could do to show that we can be trusted, but, you know, which I won't go into, but I think that, I also have to be realistic with our size and our staff and what our capacity is and do the best that I can and just be open to the feedback that I get about how we can be better.
Phil, I'm not going to let you off the hook on that one. How do you stay trustworthy?
How do we stay trustworthy? I think we have to earn it first. And I will say, in the early years of trying to use these trust-based practices, very few people believed us, right? I was like, what are you doing? What is going on here? If I only get one chance to apply, I'm not going to do this, give me anything type of thing. I think the proof is in our actions and then the way that we continue to interact. And so part of that is over time, people can see and understand kind of what you're doing, and they make the assessment. It's not up for us to say that we're trustworthy. I think it's up for our grantee partners to make that call.
I mean, like Nathan said, my accountability partner's right here beside me. But I think, similar to what they said, it's doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. And if the answer's no, tell them no. If it's yes, tell them yes. And I think that is something they appreciate, and not lead them on. But and maybe the over-communicate and get back to them, you know, before you said you would. So I think trust is built by doing a lot of those things. And then speaking into what they're doing. I think you build that over time. But it keeps us honest with ourselves as well. What would you say?
Yeah. And we try to invest and act. We don't try to bother their day-to-day, but we try to ask what they need. You know, do you need a speaker? Do you need a coach? Do you need a retreat, you know, place to have a retreat. So we try to, and I feel like instead of us telling them what we think they need to do, asking what do you need and giving them a chance to sometimes to say, I don't even know what I need. And so, you know, so sometimes what they need is a coach or a relationship. Or, and I think we try to leverage all the capital, the relational capital, the actual capital, and then, you know, and any resources that we can for them to show them that we believe in them. You know, because like the centurion, right? Like he was like, Jesus, like, I am a man of authority. You say this, and I believe you. And being an entrepreneur and having, you know, several companies, Chris knows that, you know, as a founder, they're not all 100% going to make it. So if that's the bar, then we've missed the boat. Because he's really investing in the team, you know, the leader and the team. And so we just try to just come alongside them and not be their parents, for sure, or even their, you know, managing partners or chairman of the board, but just be prayerful and be real to whatever consistent amount of communication that is fitting for that that organization.
Well, we're going to open it up for a few questions for you all. One more quote. You may be deceived if you trust too much, but you will live in torment until you trust enough. So, questions, comments, Julie. I'm going to repeat the question.
I'm going to have to talk slow, right? Because I talk too fast.
Yes, you do.
So, my question is, I think last year on the Zoom, there was a Zoom during 2020 about this. I think we had something for the gathering, which was a really great thing for me to think about and contact all the ministries we support. And then from relationships that were kind of, you know, I got really involved in what was going on with the pandemic. But my question is, building relationships with them, if they're disclosing things that are red flags, how do you manage that? Because you build this trust, and then they're trusting you, you know, that things are normal. So how do you manage that?
Julie's question is, when you have this relationship and things, red flags come up, or you find out things about them that could cause questions, how do you manage that? I'll just answer that question from Peter Uck's perspective, because this is what he told me once. You didn't know you even had this perspective, but I was becoming disillusioned with somebody, and Peter said, Fred, every dog has fleas. That solved it for me. Every dog, that was my answer, Peter's answer to that. But what happens when things pop up that cause you concern? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, great question, because the closer you get, the more you're going to possibly be in a position of trust where they lean on you. And I think it's often, I think, a cry for help in a lot of ways, and it's an opportunity to speak into it, maybe through questions. What are you doing about this? We had one ministry that we followed that we had to help wrap up, you know, and close down, kind of hand off to another one. Something along those lines. That's how it first started. And then the questioning process helped navigate that course. And we're great friends to this day, you know, and they're still in ministry, and it's different. It's kind of one of those things like, you know, when that door closes, this other one opens, and it's even better than you thought it was ever going to be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it is an opportunity to speak into them, ask questions, help navigate, walk alongside, and be a part of the solution. Because there's some kind of, you know, everything's got a solution. It may not be what you think it's going to be. But great question. But, yeah.
Nathan?
I just also chime in. Being a critical friend can build trust. And that there are some leaders that we've been in relationship with, supporting, and we just say, we don't think this is a good idea, let us tell you. Or it feels like here's some warning signs that we're seeing, and just being direct and clean about it, I think builds trust. They know that as pretending it isn't there, it's a surprise, hey, we're giving you a tie-off grant. You know, let's actually just have the courage to talk about it.
And then it's sort of up to them with what to do with that. Like, I don't think we're not giving them the feedback to say you need, like, as a power move or something. It's just, here's from where I sit, here's what we're seeing, and help us understand a little bit more. And it might be a red flag. It still might be a red flag, and we talk about it and make a decision, but might not be. It might be like we don't get their work as well as they do, you know.
Yeah, we have a saying, it's kill that monster while he's little, because he's just going to keep growing, you know? So you want to get him early. There's a quote for you.
There's a book. Questions or comments? Yes. Yes, I can hear you. How do you build trust with people that don't look like us, don't talk like us, aren't part of our culture? Because typically as funders, we are more easily drawn, more comfortable with people who do. And it's very difficult for those who don't look like us to gain our trust. And Phil, I know you've worked on this quite a bit. You have an answer to the question?
I can talk about what we do at our foundation, and that's probably the best I can do on that front. But certainly for us, equity is a huge part of what we do, and trust-based plays into that in an important way. So for us, our application process is open. And so anybody can apply, and that's one way to sort of change access. Right? You don't have to know us. You don't have to know the right people to get access to us. And as I was mentioning, our application is give us anything that you have. And the whole idea is, like, if you don't have a grant writer on staff, or you don't have one who can do this perfect, beautiful document that can accentuate all the right elements and lift it up, don't worry about it, right? Once we get that application, it's up to us to come and understand and learn about you, right? So part of the process is opening the door in a way that sort of changes the dynamic about who can come through it and who can potentially get a grant, right? And we use also a lot of different ways to reach out to communities that might not know about us. And so the whole idea is that different ways of using different languages, right, in terms of different kinds of communique, just to sort of say, here's what we do. If you think you're a good match for us, tell us about it. And so that's how we are doing the front part. And then I think that kind of changes that dynamic in terms of who might be part of that conversation.
Well, I want to be very careful about letting you go on time, and I know there are more questions, and feel free. The panel will hang around till dinner or free drinks at the bar or something. Some incentive. But I'll just leave you with something that could have been the founding verse for the gathering, and that would be, few delights can equal the mere presence of one whom we trust utterly. So I'll leave you with that. Build trust, expect trust, be trustworthy. Thank you very much for coming.